Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Scarfo Show.
Yes, everyone, welcome to another show. This week, we're doing something different. I had the pleasure to be on Jennifer Whitaker's podcast, Yes N. Jennifer is an empowerment strategist. Essentially, she works with people who have overcome obstacles and ended up coming out of it stronger and loving life. We talk a ton of strategies on how to do this, as well as her personal experience with psychedelics and so much more. Without further ado, let's get this started. A swapcast means she's going to post it and I'm going to post it. So enjoy. As always, much love. And I hope you get out of this show as much as I did. Peace, everybody. Enjoy.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to this week's episode of Yes And. I'm your host, Jennifer Whitaker. And this week we have on the show Chris Scarfo. Chris, welcome to the show. And why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yes, thank you very much for having me, Jennifer. My name is Chris, like you said. I'm a 33-year-old from Quebec, Canada, just north of Montreal, and I run a podcast called The Scarfo Show. I'm a father of one, married, I'm a twin, and currently I hold a position as an inside salesman, and that pretty much sums up who I am. And as for the show and the podcast and what I'm passionate about I'm passionate about music, health and fitness, writing, parenting, and basically learning as much about all of those little niches, as you will, as possible.
Mm-hmm. Is that what you do in your spare time?
Yes. Yeah. All of the above.
Awesome. Awesome. And I'm really excited to have you on the show today. Because you represent a huge segment of the population that my listeners haven't heard from yet on my show.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and I think it's fantastic. And what the difference is Chris, you have a day job.
Yep.
You have kind of that, 9 to 5, 8:30 to 4:30 type job.
Exactly, yeah.
And you love your life. I get so many guests on my show who are authors, who are entrepreneurs, who work from home, who don't have traditional jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost, there have been times where I felt like, oh my goodness, we are villainizing to some extent people who get up and go to work and have that 9 to 5 job. And, you know, there are people who don't love it, but you do. So welcome and tell us about your life.
Thank you. Thank you again. So essentially the reason why I guess I love my life, obviously my family life is huge. So I'm blessed to have a beautiful wife who understands and who cares and who lets me have my passion projects, if you will, mm-hmm. and a healthy, beautiful daughter who just turned 4. Well, it's a month now. Who just mm-hmm. turned 4, basically. And like I said earlier, I'm a twin. I've got 2 older sisters, my parents, and a whole host of extended family. So that's one of the reasons why I love my life. But more so on the professional side, essentially, I do my podcast. I try to do it a couple hours a week, basically. And it's kind of like my every week vacation. So it gives me kind of time to unwind and so essentially, like we were discussing off air, I recently changed my job. And for me, my day job doesn't really matter in the sense that as long as I have family time and time to pursue my passions, my 9 to 5 is a means to an end. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so it's hard not to love my life and love everything about it when I most of the time, because work is only 40 hours a week, right? So as long as mm-hmm. the rest of the time I'm enjoying myself, I'm fully satisfied. So that's mm-hmm. essentially a bit of why I love my life.
Mm-hmm. And I just think it's wonderful to hear you talk about this. And I talk about with my clients how important it is, because I work as an empowerment strategist.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means is I help people empower themselves by getting to know themselves. And I know with my journey, it took me decades really to get to know who I am and to figure out what is it that I want to do with my life. And, you know, I'm in my mid 40s. I got, I think, 13 years on you. And there are days I still don't know what I want to do when I grow up. and I think it's fantastic that you know who you are, you know what you value, and your life suits that for you.
Yeah.
And not everybody is passionate about their work. Some people are passionate about their families and about their lives, and we need to hear from that segment of the population. Everybody else I talk to all they want to talk about is their work.
Yeah. And I mean, the way I see it is because I'm living my life this way, and I found an outlet with this podcast, and now I'm way more active on social media and in, like, I'm writing blogs and journals. And so the way I see it is eventually I'm hoping to turn it into a book. And then from there, hopefully just grow my brand and be able to eventually not only love my life outside of work, but turn all my passions into a form of work. So, and then, like, I mean, I'm super happy now. I can't even imagine how happy I'll be once that happens, you know, it'll be another level of happiness.
Absolutely. And I'm going to tell the listeners what we're doing. Because Chris and I right now, because we both have podcasts, we are both recording. So this episode is going to go up on both his show and my show.
Yeah.
Which I absolutely love this idea. I'm so excited about it. This is the first time I've, what's it called? Swapcast? Is that the right word?
That's right. Yeah. Swapcast. Yeah. And it's also the first time I've done it. Essentially, I heard about it on Joe Rogan Experience. He's done it before with, like, Bill Burr. And I think they did one on New Year's Eve, not 2018 or not 2019 rather, but 2018. There was a host of comedians. So, like, it was Joe Rogan, Bill Burr, I think Bert Kreischer. I'm leaving out like four other ones, but each one who had a podcast, they recorded that night live and then they released it on all of their platforms. So when I heard that was, like, possible, you know, you're not stepping on anyone's toes and all that stuff. I mean, it sounds like a great idea, right? Kill two birds with one stone. And furthermore, like I said beforehand, like, my listeners, essentially they're listening to me for my journey, right? So what better way for them to be more so exposed than for me to be interviewed on my own show? Like, for me, that idea was phenomenal. So,
Yeah, it is. I think it's a wonderful idea and I'm excited to be part of it. So this is going to be fun to see how it turns out.
Yeah. I can't wait.
Yeah. Yep. So, one thing that I ask all of my guests about, Chris, is, tell us about some obstacles in life that you have had to overcome or overwhelm that you've had to surmount, or, you know, tell us about some adversity and how you got around it.
So obviously, I had a back injury in June. And that was one major obstacle because it basically put me on my butt for 6 months. And obviously I was, like, maybe for the first two to three weeks, I was literally bedridden. But then afterwards I was able to get to physio and get some massage therapy or physiotherapy. And then from there I moved on to ergotherapy and actual training in a gym, basically, slow and steady. So the way I surmounted that obstacle, funny enough, is I started my podcast. So being that I was home for that extended period of time, I have all the equipment for a music recording studio in my basement because I'm also a musician. But so I had all the equipment and I was like, just do it. I mean, I've been talking about doing a podcast for well over a year. And I figure I'd listened to so many podcasts and I said, they're just regular people having conversations, you know, and I tend to think of myself as a good conversationalist. And my one other obstacle was that I didn't have one niche to put myself in, because my passions are so variable. I said, do I choose one? Do I make multiple shows? And then I thought about it for a second. I said, well, most of the popular interview type shows don't really have to niche themselves, because it's interesting, you know, as long as the conversation is good, people will come back. And so I said, you know what? Don't niche yourself. Don't pick one topic. Put them all together and see what happens, right? So so that was one obstacle I overcame, and it led me to this beautiful adventure. So that I think that obstacle was really, really a blessing in disguise. And then like other obstacles, I mean, I've had job loss in the past. I was at a company for almost a decade, and then they did like an international, or not international, but a national layoff where they laid off, I think, 10% of their staff, and it was all management staff. So like replacing that income and replacing all the benefits and replacing so much that, that needed to be replaced was super difficult. But then again, I used that that break, let's say, or that time off, because obviously, or luckily enough, I was with a company that, that provided us with a like a severance package. So what I did was I used that time off and I went to school. And so I had studied in general building maintenance. Essentially, it's a, like a handyman course. So it gives you all the like basic knowledge in carpentry, plumbing, electricity, finishing, and that sort of thing. So so I use that, and like I don't have a job currently in that field, but like work around the house became so much easier. If my parents need something done, and like to do some like paint jobs and all that stuff. So it's knowledge and stuff that I'll put to use forever, you know? So both times that I've had super big obstacles, I was able to use it for personal growth. And I think that's kind of the, in a way, if you do see an obstacle, you have two ways of handling it. You can either beat yourself up and dig yourself deeper and really hit rock bottom, or you can use it to kind of your advantage, right? And I mean, it's easier said than done. It depends on the situation, and obviously, like on impact. Let's say when the obstacle hit, obviously I was downtrodden, and it did really really impact me. But I was able to come out of it, I guess, quicker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that is really a valid point. Like whenever adversity does show up in our lives, it's important to be able to figure out, okay, what's the lesson? What can I learn from this? Or is there some way to turn it around? And, you know, we all know the lemons into lemonade old saying.
Yeah.
But that saying exists for a reason, because it makes sense.
Right. Yeah. There's not only two. I was going to say there's only two ways you can react to something that's positive or negative. But I mean, in reality, there's hundreds of ways you can react to everything. But they're either on the light side or on the dark side, right? So
exactly.
And I guess it comes down to personality. If you're a positive person or like optimistic, or if you're kind of more pessimistic, that it's kind of in you. You know what I mean? But again, you can always change, right? That's another thing that my show is about, is like human optimization. So it's you don't always have to stay the same if it's not providing you with growth.
Right.
So, and like one thing that my brother said, I had my twin brother on my show for the first time last Sunday, and he said something that was great. He said if he was to be asked what the meaning of life is, it would be to live your best life. In order to do so, you have to optimize yourself and always grow. If you're always growing, your life should be a life that was worth living, and you should have no regrets, or little no regrets, depending, right? But that's kind of the meaning, right? Is to be the hero of your story. So
right, exactly. And what I would put before that whole process that you just described is you have to be aware enough of yourself to know yourself, to know what motivates you, and know what you love and what turns you on.
Yeah, 100%, 100%.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's unfortunate. I mean, I did in my life at one point, I was stuck in a spot where I didn't know myself. I didn't know what I wanted. I had a lot of adversity in my early childhood. Mm-hmm. So that put me into therapy circles, dysregulation. It dysregulated my central nervous system.
Yep.
And I carried that dysregulation with me far into adulthood until I finally found a treatment that helped me with it. And well, you're in Canada, the treatment that I received was, that I went through, the treatments are just as illegal in Canada as they are in the States.
Are you allowed to talk about them, like name them?
Yeah, I can talk about them, but I won't say the whens and wheres.
Right,
because they helped me so much. Mm-hmm. I went through psychedelic therapy.
Okay, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So my treatments included MDMA, psilocybin, and 5-MeO-DMT.
Oh wow! Yeah, I'm allegedly familiar with psilocybin, and mm-hmm. and MDMA actually allegedly. and it's funny, like we'll say when I was much younger and I was experimenting, mm-hmm. we'll say I'd never really used them, let's say therapeutically. It was always mm-hmm. recreationally, but we always, whenever me and my friends would come out of them, those experiences, we'd always definitely 100% feel different.
Yes.
And then it was only in my later adult life that I learned, obviously through Joe Rogan experience and Aubrey Marcus. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're familiar with Aubrey Marcus. He's the CEO of Onnit, and he's a writer. He also has a book called Own the Day, Own Your Life. And, okay. And yeah, essentially, he is a huge proponent, a huge enthusiast, let's say, of psychedelic treatments for anything that's like psychological, if you will. And mm-hmm. And yeah, so I haven't had the opportunity, let's say, to do any more therapeutic experiences, but it's on the to-do list potentially.
Mm-hmm. Now the clinical trials are going into phase 3 right now. I'm on the email list for MAPS. MAPS is the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. Mm-hmm. And I got an email from MAPS about a month ago that they have a call out for volunteers for phase 3.
Oh, wow.
I've already done my treatments. I did mine kind of on the underground circuit, which is why I won't give names or dates on when any of this happened, because it really did. It saved my life.
Yep.
The night before I left for my first treatment, and I flew out of the country for it, so I didn't do it in the United States. Mm-hmm. But the night before my first treatment, I went to my son's bedroom and I handed him my little lockbox that has all of my important papers in it. It has my life insurance and my will and power of attorney and all of that stuff that I have arranged for my estate.
Yep.
And I was just at my wit's end. Now, it was one of those situations from the outside looking in, you would never know how I was really feeling inside because I hid it well.
Yeah.
But I handed that to my son and I said, I'm at my wit's end. I don't know if this treatment's going to work. And if it doesn't work, you might need this because I don't know what I'm going to do.
Yeah. Yeah. And
I was done.
Yeah. And often, like you said, very elegantly, often people who are at their wit's end usually hide it because they've been close to their wit's end for so long that they're used to putting on that mask. Right.
Right.
And I mean, I've lost a few friends to suicide and, mm-hmm. We never saw them coming, right? Like obviously there was one of the cases, let's say, unfortunately there were several. One of the cases, he was like an alcoholic and, you know, he was working the same job for the last 15 years and it was like a dead end job. And you know, like, mm-hmm. so he was living at his parents' house. Mm-hmm. I mean, so like we didn't see it coming, but like, you know, anyways, it was a huge shocker, but
yeah.
But like his let's say his demeanor wasn't like suicidal, you know?
Right.
But yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess there was depression and like we saw some signs or whatever, but I didn't think it was like to get to that point, right?
So. Right. And one of the reasons people don't talk about it, which I can tell you from my personal experience and other people that I've talked to have had the same thing or similar experiences. The times that I would try to broach the topic with somebody, I was very quickly shut down. Mm-hmm. I wasn't, it was such a taboo topic that the first response somebody would give me would be, oh, you need to go see a therapist. You need professional help. And when you're already in that state of vulnerability, and somebody's coming back at you and you're right in that moment, all you need is somebody just to just to listen.
Right.
And that's it.
Right.
They don't even have to talk. Just let you listen and just kind of let you spew it out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because sometimes the word vomit helps clear out like all that emotional crap that you're feeling on the inside. So if you can just like let it out and talk about it,
mm-hmm.
that's all it takes to feel better in the moment.
Yeah.
And when I was constantly shut down by, well, you need professional help, or you need to go see a psychiatrist, or you need this, or you need that, and people telling me what I needed for myself, I would immediately just shut down and put on the smile on my face and just buck up and think, you know what, fuck you, I'll get through the night, and then I won't talk to you again. Or it would cause a rift in my friendships.
Yeah.
Because I would very quickly lose trust for those people.
Sure.
And a lot of them aren't even in my life anymore. Mm-hmm. They're just, yeah.
Yeah. They weren't adding any value, right? They were just like, they weren't really a nuisance, but they were definitely not helping. And it's funny,
right.
Professionals.
Very preachy, very preachy.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny because professionals generally are paid to just listen, right? They ask the right mm-hmm. questions, however, but so when people jump to say, oh, you need professional help. Yeah, you're right. I need someone to listen. You know, so mm-hmm. if you could stop like preaching to me that I need help and just listen, I probably mm-hmm. maybe wouldn't need help anymore, you know? But like you said, it is super taboo. And I think like mental health issues are more prominent. I think it's because more people are open to discussing it. Mm-hmm. I think that's part of it. There's obviously a whole other side of it that could get a slippery slope that I don't really want to go down, that like they're overdiagnosing or whatever. But I do think that we're at least talking about it more, and
yes,
so people are seeing it less as a taboo and more as, oh well. And one thing that I thought for a while, and I kind of still do, is we all have a certain percentage of anxiety, a certain percentage of depression, mm-hmm. a certain percentage of, like, I wouldn't go so far as everyone has schizophrenia, but we all have a conscience that talks to us, right? So
yes.
What's to say that people who are schizophrenic don't just like confuse the two, you know? And I mm-hmm. mean, sure, there's cases of schizophrenia with like multiple different mm-hmm. personalities, so more than just you and your conscience. But
mm-hmm.
I still think that on a certain scale, we all have a little bit of, maybe not everything, but we all have a little bit of something, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's exactly. And if you're aware, like you said before, if you're aware of your, not issues, but if you're aware of your symptoms, let's say, you can deal with them much, much better.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And awareness is a huge, huge part of it. Awareness is key.
Yeah,
it really is. To almost anything in life, awareness is key. If you're not aware of, and for years, this was me, I wasn't aware of how, what I lived through in childhood, how that was still affecting me in really subtle ways in adulthood. And once I became aware of it, I'm like, holy crap, I have a choice now. Now that I can see what I'm doing, my choices, which, you know, there's a vast amount of choices and possibilities, but in my mind, it whittled down to, do I want to continue doing the same thing? Or now that I know better, do I want to do better?
Right.
And I decided I wanted to do better. So I started to change.
Great choice.
Yeah, absolutely.
I wanted to ask, how long were those treatments?
They were my MDMA sessions. They were all day long sessions. So I had a day long MDMA session, and then I did a very similar protocol to what they're doing in the MDMA clinical trials mm-hmm. or the FDA clinical trials.
Yeah.
Which is three treatments about a month apart.
Okay.
So I did 3 months in a row. I traveled out of the country, you know, for a period of time in my life and received the treatment. So what I did a little bit differently than the clinical trials is I had a MDMA session, and then several days later, I had a psilocybin session.
Mm-hmm.
In the MDMA or the FDA clinical trials, they're just doing MDMA. They're
right.
not throwing psilocybin in there. They're totally separate studies. But for research purposes, they have to control the variables a little bit more.
Absolutely.
And for me personally, I needed it, because what the MDMA gave me, the MDMA taught my body how to experience things like self-love and gratitude and appreciation and compassion, mm-hmm. and especially self-compassion and self-empathy, and how to turn all of that onto yourself. Because it's so easy when I grew up in a household where my parents, it was the hidden forms of abuse or the invisible forms of abuse that took place in my house a lot. And like on a daily basis when I was a kid, it was the verbal abuse, the emotional abuse, the who the hell do you think you are? And how dumb do you think, you know, how dumb do you think I am to believe that?
Yeah. Or
how ridiculous is that? Stuff like that. Like mm-hmm. everything that came out of my mouth was minimized by my parents in one way or another. And that set at a very early age, my normal from, you know, 3, 4, or 5 years old, my normal was already established that I'm not good enough. Mm-hmm. And I have the power as a 3-year old to make my dad lose his shit if I don't behave correctly.
Yeah.
So, which, you know, we know now as an adult that we can't make anybody do anything, but as a little kid, it really distorts your sense of normal. So what I was willing to endure and put up with because of what I grew up with in my household, my normal in my household was batshit crazy to the rest of the world.
Yeah.
So what I could endure, I had like a, I guess, higher pain tolerance, mm-hmm. or I was more accepting of people's abusive behaviors because that was normal in my household.
Sure. Yeah.
So like no surprises here. I ended up in abusive relationships when I got, you know, into high school and adulthood, and, you know, like my high school boyfriend, it was just ridiculous fighting and arguing all the time.
Yeah.
Stuff like that.
And
there was a pattern. So I was stuck in the pattern until I became aware of it and was able to pull myself out. But all that stuff that you're supposed to learn in childhood from your parents holding you and cuddling you and loving you and nurturing and taking care of you, those emotions that I never learned how to feel, I finally was able to feel. And it was the medicine that showed me how to.
Yeah.
All the mindfulness stuff that I'd done over the years, because I never had that anchor point in childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of the mindfulness practices are really beneficial for people if they do have that anchor point. I would sit in therapy sessions and my therapist would ask me if I could come up with a resource from childhood, you know, like who was your safe person? I had nobody. So, and I don't think I'm the only person who doesn't have that childhood resource. So without that anchor point in childhood, I had no frame of reference.
For sure. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And, I was going to say, a lot of people, like you were saying, how, you know, you need to be aware of these things. I'm actually going to have a relationship coach on my podcast next week or the week after, and mm-hmm. and essentially what her message is essentially we're all carrying a certain amount of baggage, right? Whether we know it or not, that's the key point, is whether we know it or not, and essentially what she does is she kind of brings that to the surface, so mm-hmm. you can deal with your shit. Because she says that a pattern that she's seeing, too often is people will be in like a long-term relationship. And she says, usually the shit comes out between 2 and 3 years, you know? Mm-hmm. So you're on like honeymoon for the first year and a half, 2 years, then mm-hmm. like all your baggage comes out, you know, because you kind of mm-hmm. lose the barriers or whatever. And then she goes, right. Essentially when you're both, bringing your own shit to the table, you know, you're when you're on in confrontations or in an argument, you're really not hearing the person and you're not listening to the person. You're just arguing with your nonsense, right? So mm-hmm. she says people end up leaving long-term relationships because of this. Whereas, if people were more aware of who they are and what made them that way, they would be able to deal with their stuff. So whenever there was, because confrontation and arguments are normal, right? Mm-hmm. there's no two people on earth that were going to be seeing eye to eye every day for the rest of their lives, you know?
Right.
But it's when you're able to have a mature argument, that's when the relationship will flourish. So,
absolutely.
So it's like everyone deals with stuff, whether they know it or not. And it's really ruining relationships. It's also like ruining lives. Like you said, you were at your wit's end. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't necessarily because of other people. It was, you know, it's stuff that you didn't even know was there. Mm-hmm. So, right. So it's a really a huge thing. Like it keeps coming up is being aware of what's inside, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And the psychedelic therapy treatments really did, they just turned everything around for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It gave me the answers I had been seeking my whole life. And it made me realize that while they are within me, I just never knew how to tap into them.
Yeah. And I think Oregon is toying with the idea of utilizing psilocybin. Mm-hmm. If I'm not mistaken, yeah. I think
they're doing phase 3 clinical trials right now for both psilocybin and MDMA.
For both, okay, but separately.
And yeah, and they're separate sets of clinical trials, but they're both happening simultaneously.
Okay.
Maybe a little bit of staggering. I don't know exactly when the psilocybin trials are happening.
Right on.
But with any luck, because phases 1 and 2, you know, that's where the hard work, and phase 3 is kind of like the final cherry on the sundae.
Yeah.
So once they get through phase 3 clinical trials, they're hoping as early as 2021. These medicines can be legal in both. Wow. And this is for both the Canadian and the American FDAs.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, Canada just legalized weed in marijuana in October of this year. Mm-hmm. So across the board, essentially they leave legislation up to each individual province on they set like standards, minimum mm-hmm. standards, let's say. So 18 years of age, and certain other, like where you're allowed to consume it and all that stuff, but each province mm-hmm. is allowed to set their own actual laws type thing. So,
okay.
So it seems that the war on drugs is slowly coming to not a close, because there's still in Canada, we call them class 1 drugs, like narcotics, cocaine, heroin.
Yeah, we call it schedule 1, same thing.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. So those drugs, which have, like crazy dependency causing, let's say, compounds, whereas like mm-hmm. marijuana doesn't have any real dependency causing compounds. I don't right. think MDMA and psilocybin do either.
No, they don't. They don't. And really, like the addictive, the myth, and it is a myth. It's absolutely a myth that psilocybin or MDMA or DMT is addictive. You said that, you know, you allegedly have tried psilocybin.
Yeah.
Did you ever allegedly try psilocybin and just like be like, oh yeah, give me some mushrooms. Hell yeah.
No.
Or you're like, are you ready? You want to try this? You go first. You try it first. Cause there's always this hesitation and there's always this building up the courage to do it. It's almost like we intuitively know that, you know what I mean? It's like we intuitively know that it's going to affect us in some way that could be scary. We're not sure. And some people do have scary experiences on the medicine. But the medicines will show you, and I firmly believe this, these medicines will show you what you need to know.
Yeah, 100%.
And this is where recreational use can become dangerous. Set and setting are incredibly important.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
And there is so much that goes into the therapeutic sessions. There are sessions leading up to the day of the medicine. And, mm-hmm. you know, there's a lot of work that goes into it. And there are follow-up sessions. And you're working with a psychotherapist. And you don't have access to the medicine outside of the treatment room.
Right, right.
So if this goes legal, I had somebody make a ridiculous statement to me saying, oh, we can't legalize those medicines, then you'll have people going to the pharmacy and getting mushrooms and driving around high on mushrooms. I'm like, no, that's not how this works. It would be set up more like, in the best analogy, totally, totally different medicines, totally different effects. One's a poison, one's not. But the best analogy I can come up with is chemotherapy.
Right.
If your doctor prescribes chemotherapy for you to treat cancer, you don't go to the pharmacy and get a prescription filled for chemotherapy and then take it home, administer it yourself, and right. then go driving around on chemotherapy and,
right.
you know, throwing up black tar stuff out the window.
Yeah.
that's not how it works. You go to the doctor and you're administered the medicine by professionals, and, you know, you have somebody take you there, you have somebody bring you back. And, you know, and I think now with chemotherapy, you know, people go stay in the hospital for 3 or 4 days at a time or a week at a time. And, you know, and then they might take a month off. My mother had chemotherapy back in the 80s. So I'm a little out of the loop on what that looks like now, because right. a lot has changed since the 80s.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, but even then, now you don't have your fingers on it. Like, you really don't touch the medicines.
No. Yeah. They probably, like, I mean, the whole point, or the whole idea, I guess, behind legalizing it for medicinal use would be to set up maybe treatment centers type thing.
Yes.
I mean, they maybe eventually could even be walk-ins. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know how that will work, but
there, you have to have a trained facilitator. So you have to have some sort of psychotherapy treatments leading up to it, and right. a diagnosis, and somebody who would agree that you need these. I don't think you can just decide for yourself and walk in and get it.
Yeah, no. Yeah. I meant like a walk-in, like you can go to the, I guess I'll call it a clinic for lack of a better word, but they'll like run you through the diagnosis and treat you, let's say, through certain therapies and seeing if it would be beneficial to you. Cause like, I mean, yeah. I don't think a doctor would have the knowledge on cause you know, like I don't know about in the US, but where I'm from, like, we have maybe 30-minute conversations with our doctors when we're sick. And if not, it's once a year. So it's not, mm-hmm. They don't have enough knowledge to say, oh yeah, this kind of treatment could be good for you. Like, you need like a therapist or something with, like you mm-hmm. said, prolonged sessions. And so that's why I think at the treatment center would be probably the best idea, right. is to, you know, yes. train those therapists in a certain way that they know what to look for. They know what questions to ask. They know how to monitor Absolutely. Whether you're being truthful or not. Cause a lot of people maybe just want to get a kick out of it and like how to filter that out. Mm-hmm. But yeah. And another thing I wanted to say, I did have a friend who did take psilocybin, I think like every day for a week. He really fucking hated his life. Like, it was just not pleasant. Right. Like the first time was yeah. cool. And obviously they weren't like massive doses, but you know, so mm-hmm. the first time he tripped, he laughed his ass off or whatever. And then the second yeah. day he took it again, and it was like, well, this is different. And then so he took it until he had none left, and then he never touched it again because of how like unpleasant his whole experience was. So no, it's not a habit causing compound, and it's not definitely not pleasant to take over and over and over again.
Yeah, I don't know that I've met anybody who has done psilocybin like 7 days in a row like that. Even when I allegedly tried psilocybin recreationally.
Yeah. I mean,
which I maybe a handful of times in my life, I think maybe six
right on.
That I've used psilocybin recreationally. So it's not that much.
Yeah.
But even the very first time I tried it, you know, one of the things that was said to me was few and far between. You don't yeah. do this every weekend. You don't do this every night. You know, if you're going to smoke every night, or, you know, do something every night, smoke weed, but that's not going to hurt you. But with psilocybin, you want to use as few and far between.
Yeah.
That was the advice given to me. Now I don't know. And microdosing though, if you're doing smaller doses, which with microdosing, you don't get, if you do it right, you get too much, you'll get a little bit of the head buzz where you'll kind of see the trails or whatever.
Yeah.
Cause I have microdose also since my treatments.
Right.
The microdosing helps to reinforce the work, mm-hmm. but you'll take, I was able to find some chocolates that had okay. psilocybin in them.
Yeah.
And I would just cut like a little sliver off of them when I would microdose.
Sure.
And,
yeah.
you know, and I figured out, but it did, it really helped to reinforce, and it helped me, the microdosing helped me to, help me to integrate everything that I'd learned in mm-hmm. the sessions, because yeah. I would microdose the psilocybin even after the MDMA sessions. And on my second and third MDMA session, I was given 5-MeO-DMT at the tail end of the sessions.
Okay.
And those were really, really powerful experiences too.
Yeah.
Each medicine showed me something different and taught me something different.
Yeah.
And so there was a lot of integration. And ever since my treatments, even all the time has passed in treatments, I still don't feel like the person inside my own skin before my treatments.
Sure.
It's,
yeah. Yeah.
It's, it really is fantastic.
Yeah. And
because I was suffering before. I really was.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I believe that. That's one thing that Joe Rogan always says, especially about DMT, is that it doesn't really show you like your world. It takes you to another universe entirely, you know, and it kind of takes you to like your truth type thing. And that's like your true universe or whatever. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I haven't explored DMT because that's extremely, extremely illegal in Canada. Like, I think it's also maybe illegal in the US, but like in Canada, it's like fucking, like you get like the death penalty, and we don't even have the death penalty. You know what I mean? Like,
and that's crazy because our brains naturally will release DMT. Yeah.
Blades of grass, everything that's living excretes DMT.
Right? And and we know that DMT is released from what, the pineal gland?
I think so.
At birth and at death. And I don't know other times throughout our life. I can't help but wonder if DMT is released during near death experiences. I don't know that though, but I've often wondered.
Right, right. Yeah. I do have some friends that have tried it, I think in South America, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. And they also had one of the things that Aubrey Marcus does a lot is like ayahuasca retreats.
Mm-hmm.
And he's done ayahuasca. He's done there's another one that's name escapes me, but is also given in Peru. And
Saint Germain, the cactus.
I don't remember. It's because. For me, it sounded kind of like ayahuasca, the second plant.
Okay.
But it'll probably come to me. But yeah, he does ayahuasca retreats.
There's another name for the cactus, and I can't think of it, but I've heard it called Saint Germain too.
Okay.
And mescaline is
as
another
well. Yeah.
Another psychedelic.
Yeah.
I'm not super familiar with the cactus or
Oh, it's ibogaine. Is that the one? That's the one I'm talking
ibogaine.
About.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Ibogaine. Okay. Actually, ibogaine is incredibly helpful. So the person who facilitated my psilocybin session is a facilitator also of ibogaine sessions.
Yeah.
And this is one of the reasons that, you know, I don't want to reveal when or where or anything like that, because that particular facilitator has helped over 200 people break their opioid addictions.
Yeah, absolutely.
With ibogaine.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's illegal. And like I don't know.
I mean, that it's also like kratom.
It's illegal.
You know, kratom. Is also another very illegal substance. Or I think they're trying. It was legal for a while, and then they. I don't know if it was banned or not. But I know the.
I think ibogaine and kratom were just made illegal within the last 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, because I know
like
kratom was legal.
Or 11 or 12 or something, yeah.
Yeah, I was even thinking, I think ibogaine, yes, but I think kratom was even more recently, like in 2015 or so.
That could be true.
But they both have been proven to cure, and not only opioid addictions, like... Aubrey Marcus was mentioning that some people in his at the retreat were coming off of like alcohol addiction, cigarette addiction. It basically, from his experience, he says it took him back to back in time in his whole life. He would go through different experiences, either with his father or with childhood friends, with mentors, with enemies, and he would basically be able to relive these experiences, and from the way he described it, was kind of like all kinds of experiences that he had regrets from. So he was able to relive them and erase his regrets. So and apparently it was like a super psychedelic experience. Cause he was like, he goes, I don't understand how I was able to do this, but yet still be in Peru. You know, he's like, cause I could feel everything. I could hear everything, smell everything. But yeah, he was talking about how it's super transformative. And that's one of the reasons why all these treatments to me make perfect sense. And I do eventually want to experience them, because I, even if you're aware or I believe I'm aware there's probably some shit that's hiding somewhere, right? But even if you're happy, even if you're aware, I still see there's benefits, because you could only, like, it's not going to, I don't think anyways, but I don't think you'll be able to digress. Like, you'll only be able to move upwards, you know? Right. So.
Yeah. And that's why set and setting is important, because there are contraindications.
Right.
So I know you mentioned earlier in the conversation, you brought up schizophrenia as an example. If I remember correctly, I'm pretty sure schizophrenia, if it's an it's a true diagnosis of schizophrenia, is a contraindication.
Sure.
For some of these medicines.
Yeah.
And you were just talking about, you know, breaking addiction to alcoholism.
Yeah.
I don't think a lot of people realize that, I can't think of his name, the guy who founded Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't think of his name, but LSD was not always illegal. I think it was made illegal in the late 60s or early 70s, mm-hmm. the whole Timothy Leary era. And the guy who founded Alcoholics Anonymous actually went through LSD therapy to break his addiction to alcohol.
Right, right on.
And then didn't pull it into the Alcoholics Anonymous framework.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. So I can't help but wonder, just seeing the effects on me and how it helped turn around what I believe was a complex form of PTSD that I was suffering from. I didn't have an official diagnosis. So I can't help but wonder how many other people could be helped with their addictions if these medicines weren't illegal, and how many people have suffered over the last, you know, half a century or more.
Millions.
It's crazy.
I wouldn't even consider it a stretch to say billions of people could be helped. Right. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, if you were speaking about, on a global scale, right. Cause there's other countries where it's certain compounds are legal. But nevertheless, if we stay just in North America, then we're definitely talking about in the millions. So,
yeah,
because like,
and it depends on where you live. So talking about Canada, legalizing weed back in October, I read an article right after that it was South Korea.
Okay.
I forget what country it was, but they put a warning out to all their citizens, like, okay, we don't care if you travel to Canada. If we find out that you did, you know, smoked weed while you were in Canada, and then you come back here and we find out about it, or if we test, or how, I don't know if they can do that. It's a whole different country, so they have rules that I don't get.
Yeah.
But if they find out that they smoked weed in Canada, they're punishable by the laws in that country. So basically they believe the laws follow you wherever you go on the planet for the country that you reside in.
I read the same thing. One of the things that was talked about here is because in Canada every province I think has online sales, so you're able mm-hmm. to purchase and it gets delivered to your door basically. Mm-hmm. However, I think you have to purchase it with a credit card. I'm not sure if it works with PayPal or anything like that yet. And mm-hmm. one of the things that was being discussed was that, at the border crossing into the States, they were saying that they're going to be able to use that information and refuse you entry, into the US if you've ever purchased cannabis and stuff like that. I don't know if it was going to be like on a case per case basis type thing, but I didn't understand how they can, like, so they're automatically granted access to my credit card, you know what I mean? Like, it was kind of fuzzy, and I don't remember the source. I don't want to say it's a reliable source or not, but that's mm-hmm. one thing that was discussed on local news. I've been off. I haven't smoked weed basically in I think going on 28 days. Mm-hmm. like 4 weeks. And, I'm kind of in a cleansing time right now. Mm-hmm. I'm also doing a 21 day water fast.
Okay.
They're not coincided because I hadn't smoked weed since before the holidays, and my mm-hmm. My water fast started on January 2nd. I'm kind of trying to see multiple things, like how I could clear my mind, how I can heal my body, how I could heal my relationship with foods and all that stuff. Like I said, my podcast is really oriented on optimizing my health, my mind, my spirit, my everything, right? So mm-hmm. I see it as both of those journeys as a way to do all of that, you know? But yeah, so I haven't purchased any weed online. I did, whilst I was smoking, I did go in stores. And it's funny, you maybe didn't hear, but we did it like really, really horrendously, essentially in Quebec anyways. Mm-hmm. Within, I think the first week, there was no more stock anywhere.
Heard that you guys sold out like a day or something.
Yeah, and I mean, I was discussing this with my brother on my last podcast. Like, if you asked, you could have asked me, and I would have told you, at least 33% of the population smokes weed.
Mm-hmm.
So just do the math. You know what I mean? Right. Like, go
or
by
33% admit that they smoke weed.
Right. Yeah. So even go higher. Right.
I think so. I think there's probably a third that admit it and they're totally open about it. Probably a third that sneak around and do it. And
right.
Probably
yeah.
a third that somewhere in that last third, I'd say it's split between teetotalers who are totally against it and the rest of them who are curious that
right.
would try it if they had the chance, but wouldn't seek it out.
Yeah. Yeah. And so like, I mean, yeah, so we sold out super quick and now they're only open Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Because if they were open all week, they would sell it every week. And like we only have, if I'm not mistaken, I think 5 or 6 brick and mortar locations in the province.
Okay.
And there was lineups everywhere. Like at each location, there was at least an hour wait to get in the door.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, yeah. who didn't see that coming? You know, I saw that coming from a mile away. However, what I didn't see coming was that the lineups would progress after week 1, week 2, week 3, week 4. I haven't gone in front of the location because it's like I don't drive by it basically. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't be surprised to see that there's still possibly lineups, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's actually now 3 locations that are going to be open up Wednesdays, but they're mm-hmm. like they're like kind of not like not part of the big cities, you know what I mean? They're like on the outskirts, so
yeah,
it's not super surprising, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, like, get your shit together. Like, I mean, right. it's funny, we all my friends and acquaintances or whatever, we say like we have the Hells Angels in Quebec, basically. They're a biker gang from
We have them here too.
yeah they're pretty much everywhere. But mm-hmm. So we're all joking, we're like, fuck, if you sell out, just ask the Hells, they'll gladly sell you some at a profit, you know?
Right. Right.
So
yeah, and it's amazing to me how many people like experiment with just trying to grow it in their homes.
Yeah
I don't know if you have that in Canada, but I know a handful of people who, you know, have a closet or something. I talked about it at one point because I bought a house a couple years ago and had it remodeled before I moved in, and then I just never followed through with it because, you know, life.
It's a lot of work.
It is. That's what I keep hearing. I keep hearing how much work it is, and I'm like, I just don't have the kind of time to dedicate to it, and I work from home, so I'm like, yeah, I just kind of. It was a fun thing to think about, but actually implement it and try it, I just didn't have the time. I can't even keep a normal house plant alive.
Right. Yeah. Me too. And it's funny, this coming spring, one of my projects is to do a garden with my daughter. So kind of like grow our own food and experiment with that. I want to get some chickens. There's a mm-hmm. host of things that I want to start doing.
Mm-hmm.
But yes. And I had a buddy that had a couple plants in his closet, but it was crazy. It's way too much work. And I mean, sure, the product that he yielded was superior to, let's say, what we were getting from our pusher, mm-hmm. but still, it was a lot of work. Depending on how much space you have and how tall you let them grow, you can have a great yield. But it's still, I mean, especially now that it's legal, you can go to a store. Like, it's fuck that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and what you just mentioned is another reason why I think legalization is incredibly important. Because if history has taught us anything, like, prohibition doesn't work. Like,
absolutely.
Any time we've ever tried to prohibit anything, it's been a huge failure.
Yeah.
So, and if you look at Portugal, the country of Portugal, back in 2000, they decriminalized all drugs.
Right. Yeah.
Now, decriminalization is not the same thing as legalization. So decriminalization means, you know, if you're caught with a certain amount and you're not selling it, but you just intend to use it, then you don't get prosecuted. You don't get put into the system. You don't get thrown into prison,
right.
You know, for things like that.
Yeah, maybe you catch a fine, but...
Right. It's still illegal to, you know, be a drug dealer in the sense of the word, you know, and what they do. And one thing I love about what Portugal does is, at least from I'm saying this never having been to Portugal, but the research that I've done on it and stuff that I've read about it is Portugal is they have a better understanding of addiction and what the antidote to addiction is, because the opposite of addiction is connection.
Okay.
So when people feel like they're not connected, people feel like they're not understood.
Yeah.
And even back when I was in, you know, the more suicidal phase of my life, I was smoking a lot more weed because it was a coping mechanism and it helped me feel good. And that was another thing that really helped me survive that time in my life. And, you know, and I had it illegally. I know I did.
Yeah.
Because it's not illegal or not legal in the state that I live in the United States.
Right. And I don't know I would think so, but are you familiar with the Rat Park experiment?
Yes, absolutely.
So, I mean, for listeners who maybe aren't aware, they put rats with two bowls. One of them was a bowl of just water. One of them was a bowl with cocaine in the water. And they put them in individual cells or individual offices type things. And the rats consumed cocaine water till there was none left or till they died. Then they put them in a park type thing with multiple rats, and they're like they could get some exercise, they had food, blah 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 blah. And those rats,
it was like rat heaven.
Yeah, exactly. And essentially what they saw was it was pretty much 50-50 if I'm not mistaken, but some of the rats consumed cocaine. But not until
it wasn't. They would go for the water every now and then. They would go for the cocaine.
Right.
Water.
Okay. And all of them.
Yeah. There was still some, but for the most part, of the rats would go to the water, and every now and then they get a little sip of the cocaine water. But I don't know that they had any rats in Rat Park that And I don't remember, correct me if I'm wrong here, I don't remember any of them drinking the cocaine water until they died like they did when they were isolated in the cage by themselves.
Right, I don't think so either.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's...
Because it was more like you saw the rats go into recreational use.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Right.
And that's huge. Like I never used those two terms, addiction and connection, together. That's awesome.
Because
and it's so true.
When people turn to substances, when people turn to drug addiction, that's because they're so in such a state of suffering and despair inside themselves that people can't stand to be present for themselves in their own life. So they're turning to substances so they can numb out and not have to be present in their own life, because somehow they're so miserable in their own life, they just can't take it anymore.
Yeah.
And that's what leads to addiction. And addiction can show up in almost any form. It can show up in the form of drug use, alcohol use, you know, cigarettes, tobacco. There's all the big stuff that we know of.
Yeah.
Stuff that we don't think of as addiction. And this is where, again, circling back to the beginning of the conversation, this is where you have to know yourself.
Yeah.
So there are people out there who are addicted to things like exercise.
Yep.
And now that doesn't mean that every marathon runner is addicted to exercise, but there are some of them that use, you know, marathon running or the hours each week that you have to put in to train for a marathon or to maintain that type of athletic status.
Yeah.
That it becomes a form of avoidance.
Yeah,
and they get addicted to the endorphins that are released. And y'all have Dr. Mate, Gabor Mate in Canada. I'm a huge fan of Dr. Mate. I actually haven't announced this yet, so this will be the first time I announce this on the air. Dr. Mate has a compassionate inquiry program, and for the past few years that I've been aware of, he's been doing weekend workshops called Compassionate Inquiry Workshops.
Okay.
He just developed a year-long program so people can train, therapists can train to be compassionate inquiry practitioners.
Mm-hmm.
And I got accepted into the program.
Congrats.
Thank you. So I'm in the first round of trainings, and it is a year-long training, and we start class next week.
Awesome. And that's all given online?
It is. It's all online, and we have, we had to agree to set aside, between 4 and 6 hours a week, and so there will be weekly meetings where I'm either in dyads, triads, or in a larger group, for the whole year. This won't be over until December. But I love the work that Dr. Mate is doing with people because, he's really, really realizing that addiction is something that we crave. And addiction is something that, because of that craving and our need to find it, it disrupts our life. So what he has exposed is, again, one of those hidden in plain sight things that's been there all along. And it's not just addiction to substances or foods or whatever. It can be addiction to behaviors. He talks a lot about behavioral addictions. And following his work was really eye-opening for me because it brought to my awareness that I did have some behavioral addictions, and I have really had to work hard to break those once I became aware of them because they were so ingrained. And that has taught me to play with the subtleties of my behavior. And what I've realized is I had this tendency where if I could put myself in the role of the victim and I could blame somebody else instead of taking responsibility myself, that was how my behavioral addiction would show up. So I spent a lot of my life where everything was somebody else's fault. And now that I look back, I'm like, you know what? It was nobody else's fault but my own. It was my life. I'm the one, you know what I mean? And don't get me wrong, there are situations that happen in life that are not our fault. And shit happens to people. Like I'm guessing it was not your fault that your back was injured. It was just an accident, something that happened. There's no reason to place blame in a situation like that. But when shit like that happens, you have to take responsibility for your own healing and for your own life and for moving forward. And sounds like that's what you've done because here we are and on your podcast and on mine.
And yeah, the if I may, the one thing that you can change regardless of something is of your fault or not. Or if it's someone else's fault or not, is how you react, right? So even if the like you are a victim in that situation or in a situation, it's how you react to that that will depict the future, right?
Absolutely, 100%.
And talking about addiction, you were saying like behavioral, but like I just saw, it's funny, it came in the form of a meme. But like there was basically, it was like a doctor and he was like had a chart or whatever, and it's like, okay, so let's see what form of addiction you have. And there was like, okay, so drugs, alcohol, cigarettes, food, but then there was like pornography, binge watching Netflix, exercise,
Absolutely.
You name
Video
it, right?
games,
So, and it's all, they're all
our
coping.
phones
Oh
as
my
we
God.
scroll.
Exactly. Social media, and it's all coping mechanisms, right? You want to hide from the reality. And I mean, that's another thing that I, why I'm doing this whole 21 day water fast and all that stuff is because I did see myself like it was those kind of like, I never said like I was addicted to weed, right? Even though I was a daily user for a long, 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 long time. I never considered myself addicted, and but I also never considered myself addicted to binge watching Netflix. But guess what? I do that. I never considered myself addicted to sweets and to foods and all that stuff. But guess what? I was overeating. So there's all things that you maybe don't see it right away, or you don't see the impact it's having. However, like there's certain ways to, if you're able to cut them out completely. And I think essentially the goal is coming out of the 21-day water fast. I'm hoping, and we'll only time will tell, but I'm hoping that I'll be able to, instead of having like a whole row of cookies, I want to be able to have one or two, but enjoy them so much because I was deprived for 3 weeks, right? That one or two is like pure bliss, you know? And that's kind of what I'm trying to achieve. But also, coming out of the 21-day fast, I'm also making a point to really go for like organic foods. I'm gonna toy with let's say a little bit of plant-based proteins. I'm still gonna stay significantly a meat eater because I am a meat eater. I love meat, right? But I do want to kind of maybe eat a little bit less, right? So
yeah,
like mess around.
We love the plant-based proteins.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, we really love them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then like I keep seeing these recipes for like General Tso soy soy tofu rather, and like so yeah, essentially I want to toy with that because I, like I said, I love meat, but I don't think 100% that all meat comes with let's say like negative side effects, but I do think anything in too large amounts does, even if the side effects are small, it's compounding, right? So, so that's
too much of anything can become toxic in the body.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. So that's kind of, it's kind of where I want to shift basically coming off of this. But essentially the main goal is really like to eat organic whole foods. And like, I want to do essentially, I'll do like a cheat meal type thing on Sunday with the, we're Italian, right? So every Sunday we go to my parents for supper. It's kind of, it's kind of a thing. But so like on Sundays, I'll eat whatever they eat, whatever's served, whatever we bring or whatnot. And then on Monday, I'll do a 24-hour fast. So, because I used to do like intermittent fasting where I would eat lunch and supper, but I would fast overnight and then for breakfast. Funnily enough, I recently learned that that's not the best way to do intermittent fasting because your caloric, your metabolic rate basically slows to not a halt, but it really slows overnight. So if you want to do a real intermittent fasting with a 16-8 like window, so like an eight-hour feeding window and a 16-hour fasting window, you want to include your sleeping more so in your 8-hour feeding window, or at least make a lot of your day where you're active in your fasting window, which a lot of people, they're like, well, I'll eat from 12 till noon. So, you know, that includes lunch, a snack, supper, a snack, and then you go to bed, right? But then you fast overnight where you're still metabolizing, so you're not really fasting yet. And then let's say maybe it takes 2 hours, 3 hours for your body to finish digesting. So you only really start your fast at like 11 o'clock. And then they say, well, okay, so I'll go till noon. That's really only 13 hours of fasting. And from 11 till, let's say, when you wake, so another at least 5 hours if you wake at 6 and probably more, you're really not burning anything, right? So ideally, you want to, some people do only breakfast, rather, or like breakfast and a light lunch, and then they fast from 12 till the following morning. And but yeah, so I was doing intermittent fasting before, but I want to be able to do just a 24-hour fast once a week. And like I said, eat like a proper breakfast with like eggs and whatever. I don't want to be too restrictive. As long as I feel, as long as I'm eating whole foods with tons of vegetables, fruits, and like really cutting out like sweets and breads and all that, all those kind of unhealthy carbs, I think you don't really have to, you only have to like fast more than that. You know what I mean? I don't think you need to kill yourself, right?
Yeah. And I think there's a little bit of also like figuring out what works for you.
Right. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And if you don't do some of these little experiments, like, you know, maybe you'll discover that, wow, I feel fantastic after this, you know, 21-day water fast. I'm going to do that like once a year or twice a year or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, it's finding out what's right for you. Cause I don't believe, I don't know about anybody else, but I don't believe there's a one size fits all diet that works for everybody across the board.
Not at all.
There are too many variables from person to person, from just way too many variables.
Yeah. And Chris Kresser, he talks about this a lot. He's been on Joe Rogan Experience several times, but he also has, I think he has his own podcast. But if you go to chriskresser.com, you'll find all his details. He discusses what he says is a nutrivore diet. So it's really, really based on nutrient dense foods. So he includes fruits, vegetables, meats. I don't remember if there's a ton of grain, but probably. But essentially, what he says is exactly that there's so many variables. There's genetics. There's lifestyle.
Blood type.
Yeah. And he goes like, I mean, if you're looking at one of the examples that he gives, if you're looking at a 65-year-old male who's obese and sedentary, compared to a 25-year-old female who's an athlete, mm-hmm. how could they consider eating the same diet? It makes absolutely right. no sense, you know?
Right.
So there is no one size fits all. You gotta, and I love
maybe
experimenting.
The problem is they both do eat the same diet.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Maybe.
Maybe that's part of the problem.
So that's, there definitely is no one size fits all. And yeah, I will essentially, when I break the fast, the way you're supposed to break a water fast is, you start with some fruit or veggie juices, and mm-hmm. obviously fresh, not store-bought. Mm-hmm. and then you can incorporate some bone broth. Okay. Then you could do like some kimchi or some sauerkraut, anything that's like fermented. People say if you want to go the dairy route, you could use like, you could eat kefir. Mm-hmm. then after you want to go to boiled veggies, or steamed veggies rather. And mm-hmm. then you could kind of incorporate, eggs, bacon, small, like a, let's say whole wheat toast with butter. And then eventually you work up to, having small meals and then full meals, and then you're free to eat whatever you want as you please. And I'm also super interested in seeing how reincorporating all these foods are going to affect me. Like, I don't know.
I was just getting ready to say that. I was going to ask you if you would follow up with me, because when you were talking about cookies earlier, I am so curious to know how those cookies taste after this.
Yeah.
Fast,
oh, yeah.
Especially if you start to really, especially as you break the fast, if you're putting really good, healthy foods into your body.
Yeah.
What I experienced when I gave up, just like soda pop.
Yeah.
I gave up soda pop probably, 10, 12 years ago easily. And for probably the past decade, except for rare occasions, the only time I drink soda pop is, you know, I'll have Coke if there's some Jack in it every now and then.
Right,
it's usually in a mixed drink, or some ginger ale if there's some gin in it or something.
Right on, right on.
But I don't, and I don't drink alcohol that much anymore either. But I'd be curious to know, because when I drink soda, I can't stand it. I can taste the chemicals in it.
Right,
because
right.
Because I cleaned all that crap out of my body. So I'm curious to know if those cookies will even taste the same to you.
Yeah, and one of the things that I've been doing, it kind of seems counterintuitive, but one of the things I've been doing is really watching like cooking shows and reading mm-hmm. up on super healthy recipes and all that stuff. And I'm really noticing that there's a ton of ways to get those sugar fixes and all that stuff, but in healthy ways, you know?
Yeah,
so like
I'm
really looking forward to trying all these healthy recipes. But then again, I'm also waiting for the Sunday to kick my ass, you know, like, cause for sure if I have cake or if I have whatever, and you really, you don't have it often, it's, mm-hmm. I can't see it being super. I mean, there's obviously, it'll be pleasurable to like it's going to secrete serotonin and all that stuff, right? Or dopamine, rather. So I will get like a reward or whatever. But I think my digestive system will hate me. And I think...
I don't know. You might not get the reward, because foods that used to give me a reward don't anymore.
Maybe. I'm hoping. Yeah. I'm hoping I don't. But
I'd love for you to follow up and let me know how that goes.
Yeah, 100%.
I'm really curious.
I have, if you reach out anywhere on social media at The Scarfo Show, I have a blog on WordPress. I'm on Instagram. My mm-hmm. Twitter game is off. I just share my Instagram posts to Twitter. So if people prefer Twitter, they can find me there. But on Facebook, everything is at The Scarfo Show. And I had promised my listeners to give day-to-day updates. However, I haven't updated since day 4. I kind of slacked. But I have been writing my daily updates. I just haven't published them. So, but everything will be up, and mm-hmm. and when I break the fast too, I will give probably weekly updates or whatever. We'll see how, like, we'll see what comes up, right? If anything's like super cool, I'll post it right away. But yeah, and I'm like on my Instagram, I had made some kimchi, so it's still fermenting in my fridge now. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna be making some bone broth, some organic bone broth. A ton of stuff. So there, everything that that people want to see is, it will be up, and mm-hmm. yeah. So.
Well, I'll make sure that I throw up a link in the comments section. You know, where people can read about what this episode's about. I'll make sure I put a link to your website, and so people can find all that.
Cool. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm pretty close to being out of time. And so, Chris, do you have any final words or bits of wisdom you'd like to leave with our listeners today?
I'd like to say, first of all, thank you very much, Jennifer, for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, you're welcome. This has been really interesting, and I'm loving this experiment. I can't wait to see how this goes.
But if I did have a word of advice, is really take the time to love yourself, love your life, because you only have one. As far mm-hmm. as I know, you only have one. Feel grateful every morning that you wake up and take a breath. It's super important. And yeah, if you really, really, really despise the situation you're in, just get the fuck out. There's always a way out. There's always things that you can do to change. Or you can be like me and pursue your passions after your day job, if you still have a day job, you know? And like I said, I'm surrounded by family that loves me. I'm surrounded by a great circle of friends. That's super important. Like you said before, addiction connection. I definitely have a great circle, and that helps, obviously. Mm-hmm. But just find, and it's funny, Gary Vaynerchuk says this all the time, find what you're good at and what you enjoy and triple down on that.
Yes.
And there's no way you can't be happy. There's no way that you will not find happiness at the end of that road. And obviously there's chances that you're going to have to take. You may not always be rich. You may not always have the wealth or whatever, but if you follow your path that you've created, it will come. Mm-hmm. And that's why I say, like, I'm currently, like I said, my job, I could do whatever. I could be a dishwasher. I could be a cook. I could be a salesman like I am now. I could almost literally do whatever. As long as my bills are paid, it's my after hours that really, really excites me and really is what I'm passionate about. So that's my last, my ending message.
I think that is absolutely wonderful. And it has been such a pleasure to have you on the show today, Chris. Thank you for being here.
Have a great evening.
Thank you. And for all of our listeners out there, I'll see you next week. And it's been wonderful. Have a great day.
Peace, everybody. So that has been another fantastic edition of the Scarfo Show. I hope you like the idea of swapcasts, because I probably will be doing a couple more in the future. I guess essentially the whole message behind this show is, no matter what obstacles you face, you have the choice on how you react to them. And there are so many tools on how to better come out, or how to come out stronger, basically. So everybody, if you can like, share, comment, subscribe, it would really help out. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, especially, please reach out on all social media platforms at The Scarfo Show. Keep your ears open for fire content coming in the future. I've got a keto specialist, a ketogenic specialist coming on in the near future. I've got a relationship specialist coming on as well. And so much more. Stay tuned for also updates on my 21-day water fast. When you hear this, I'll be on day 12, still going strong. As always, much love. Be good. Peace.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Scarfo Show.